So thank you for hanging in for this last talk of the session, and I know it's going to be followed by a panel discussion, so I hope you'll stick around for that as well. So I'm delighted to be here, and I thank the conference or the section organizers for inviting me to talk to you about our first year establishing a research network for promoting healthy weight among children with autism spectrum disorders and developmental disabilities. I also didn't get the memo about disclosures, and I also have nothing to disclose relevant to this talk. So as many of you may know, obesity in children with developmental disabilities is a significant problem. The obesity epidemic is a pandemic, and really there are no groups that have been unaffected by it nationally and internationally. And true for all children are the chronic disease and secondary health conditions associated with childhood obesity, as well as psychosocial consequences. But particularly for this population, we think that there are important implications in terms of their ability to live independently as they become adults. And this dovetails well with the prior presentation. So the obesity prevalence data in this population are imperfect, but the data that we've looked at, we think, suggests that children in these groups are at equal or greater risk for obesity. And this is a slide that was put together for an international conference where we looked at the extent to which children with ASD in different countries have elevated risk. And these data from around the world are compared with the U.S. prevalence of at about 15% prevalence of obesity in the typical population. And you can see that around the world, and particularly in the U.S., and these data are from a nationally representative sample, there are elevated prevalence compared to the general population. This is a slide that comes from a paper that was published a couple of years ago by Jim Rimmer, and I noticed that he was a co-author on a prior presentation. He's done a tremendous amount of work in the intellectual disability population. And you can see here that compared, again, to typically developing individuals with autism, Down syndrome, and intellectual disabilities have elevated risks. This is actually based on a web survey that he did. The Maternal and Child Health Bureau funds this network that I'm going to be talking to you about. The funding actually comes from the Combating Autism Act of 2006, and then as amended by the Reauthorization Act in 2011. And I think it's important that NCHB has decided that doing health promotion in this population is an important place for them to put their resources. So the Combating Autism Act was funded to increase awareness, reduce barriers to screening and diagnosis, and to support research on evidence-based interventions for autism spectrum disorders. It also has a training purpose, and they fund the LEN programs across the U.S. So our research team for leading this network includes three co-directors, Linda Bandini and Carol Curtin, who are both at UMass Medical Shriver Center, and myself from Tufts. The funding provides a little bit of support for a research associate, a statistician, for some administrative support. And this is not a research grant, it's a cooperative agreement, so MCHB is heavily involved, and we have monthly conference calls with our program officers. So the mission that was established by the members is to advance the understanding of obesity risk factors in children with ASD and other developmental disabilities, and to promote the evidence, the development of evidence-based solutions to achieve healthy weight in this population. And we have a strong goal to disseminate our research findings both to the research community but also to consumers of research and self-advocates. So those of you, I don't know how well steeped this group is in the obesity risk factor world, but this is a socio-ecologic framework look at obesity risk factors that was adapted from a paper published by Davison and Birch about 15 or 13 years ago now. And it organizes risk factors for obesity into different levels at going from both going from the individual to the family and peer group, and then to the community and broader society. We know a lot less about what the risk factors are for children with ASD and IDD, and we assume that many of them are the same, but there are also probably unique risk factors associated with these conditions, including food selectivity, motor impairments, some differences in body composition for some specific developmental disabilities like CP, sleep problems, sensory sensitivity, and medication use. At the family or peer level, there are often families are very stressed by raising children with these disabilities, so there are competing time demands that may influence physical activity patterns in the family, use of food as a reward, family dynamics, family stress, which can be substantial, mealtime stress, which can be substantial, especially in families with a child with ASD, and screen use patterns that appear to be a little different in these families. At the community level, we know that there are lots of barriers to inclusion of these youths in physical activity programs, and there may even be some issues in school PE in terms of providing adaptive PE for children with these conditions. So given the complexity of obesity risk factors, as we put together the members of this research network, we realized that we really needed a multidisciplinary group of researchers. So the team of members includes people with backgrounds in nutrition, in physical activity, in adaptive PE, in social work, in behavioral intervention, pediatrics, psychiatry. I'm just sort of looking at these people and thinking about what they bring, and general health services. We also have several advisors who represent families, represent Special Olympics, represent self-advocates, and also some of the sister networks that that MCHB funds through the Combating Autism Research Program. So our first step that we undertook actually before our kickoff meeting was to start the process of developing a research agenda. I mean, there's way too much to do for mortal souls to get this work done in a reasonable amount of time. Our initial funding is 3 years. We are actually doing everything we can to make sure that we will be funded moving forward as well, because I have to say I've never really had such a great research experience. It's just so wonderful to be working with folks from all these different disciplines on this issue. So we used a modified Delphi process, which is really just a fancy process for doing what anybody would do if you were trying to develop something with a group. So before we had our first meeting, we surveyed our members and advisors via a web survey and just asked them what they saw as the key research gaps that needed to be addressed in an effort to prevent and treat obesity in youth with autism and other developmental disabilities. And then we aggregated their responses into broad themes, which actually turned out to be a pretty hard thing to do, but we did it in several iterations and brought that to our first kickoff meeting, which was about a year ago today. And during that meeting, we expanded on ideas and then resurveyed the group following the meeting to come up with the top four themes, then we ended up expanding to five themes because there was sort of a tie and it seemed to make sense. So the five themes that we came up with are as follows: family practices around food and meal times, physical activity and sedentary behaviors in relationship to weight, the relationship between food patterns, behaviors, and weight gain, the influence of school and community-based organizations on food intake and physical activity, and then a fifth theme around adaptation of existing programs and program delivery. So the specific goals that we have for this, to meet the goals of our research agenda, are to fund two pilot projects annually for members and also associate members, and I'll tell you in a minute about how you might become an associate member if you're interested, to conduct formative or preliminary studies in this area that are that resonate with our themes. We also are committed to conducting at least one study each year using existing data to add to the knowledge on prevalence, risk factors, and other relevant correlates of weight status in this population, and to collaborate on at least one grant proposal to be submitted to leverage the small amount of money that we're getting from MCHB to greater funding resources. So we're organized into three cores. The administrative core are the people who are actually funded by MCHB, so the directors and our research associate. And then we have a pilot and feasibility core, a secondary data analysis core that I lead, and a dissemination core that's led by Carol Curtin. Our dissemination goals are major, and actually this talk today is part of our meeting that goal. But we also are committed to submitting at least two manuscripts to peer-reviewed journals every year to disseminate results from our research network and publications, products, and events like today to the research community, but also to adapt those for family members and self-advocates, to present research funding at conferences and workshops, to disseminate to relevant disability-focused programs and organizations, to develop our HWRN website, which we launched a couple of weeks ago at our second annual meeting, to launch a listserv of interested researchers and others, and to disseminate a research digest, which is a periodic compilation of journal articles in the field. So the research digest, which we're just going to be sending out hopefully before the end of November, this is just actually an extract that we put together to show people what it would look like. So it would come into your email. These would all be hyperlinks, and you could click on them and get abstracts, or if they're open access, the full articles that are being published in key categories. And this is, as I said, not exhaustive, but just an extract of what a research digest would look like. This is a screenshot of our website. This is now the infomercial part of the presentation, where I invite you to come up afterwards and get a magnet for your refrigerator or file cabinet, and also we have some flyers of what we're trying to do. You can become active as an associate member if you'd like to be able to apply for research funds. You can send your CV to us, or if you just would like to subscribe to the listserv or to the research digest, we'd love to have your name. You can, on the flyer there is an email that you could inquire about associate membership, and this is a great opportunity for us to serve as a resource to try to move the field forward. I mean, I think all of the presentations in this panel have sort of suggested that we know that individuals, whether they're children or they've aged out of childhood, they really have very strong needs for healthy living and to benefit from research on health promotion for this population. So thanks so much for your attention, and a year from now when I come back, I hope I'll have some data to present and have a positive affirmative answer to this question about whether or not we're making an impact. So I think this is a segue now for panelists to come up and answer questions. So thanks so much.
Thank you. No, yes. I'm going to come around with the mic, and if you have a question or a comment, please raise your hand and identify yourself so we know who you are. All right.
Hi, my name is Emily Fisher. I'm a student at Eastern Virginia Medical School. My first question is for the first gentleman. Was the data, the individuals coming out of institutions, was it just one institution that they were coming out of?
No, there were at least seven or eight.
Okay. And then did you look and see if those institutions had federal violations? I didn't know if maybe that was an aspect or health or anything.
There was one who was actually shut down because of a federal violation. The rest were actually, a couple were voluntary, were closed by the state, and a couple were tried to be closed, but were successfully kept open by advocates. There was one that's in the process of being closed. The state got sued to keep it open. They were allowed to keep it. They were allowed to close it, but there was a change in governors, so we're gonna have to wait and see what happens.
Okay. And then, do you know if any of those individuals utilized Money Follows a Person?
No, I'm not. I don't think we know that yet. With the data we have, we don't know that. I think it is possible, but I'm not sure.
Okay. And then my second question, well, third, I guess, is for the other gentleman. Are you planning on taking your training to consumer-directed support professionals rather than agency-directed?
Yeah, that's a really good question. For now, no. This has been a wicked huge project. We are still maybe a fifth of the way through the analysis. Eventually, I think it does need to go to consumer direction. The question I would ask about that, though, is what really constitutes consumer direction? I heard that you're from Virginia.
Yes.
I am, too. I would say that even though the state has it, we don't. So I think that we'd have to be really careful in how we construe the idea of self-direction, because it would change a lot about the implementation of the training.
And I have one more question. Are you going to watch the game tonight?
What game?
Basketball game? You are not a...
Oh, is tonight the opener? I don't really care because I'm not there, so they won't screw up my traffic.
Hello. My name is Steve Davis. I'm representing PHMC here in Philadelphia. I'm also a student at Walden University. Work on my PhD. Have lots of questions. I'll try to keep it very small. Very limited. For the advanced children that did the study with the direct support staff, I've read a lot of the work of Larson and Wood on direct support staff. I started my career in this. So a lot of it is dead on point. One of the questions that I had was, in terms of the regulations of organizations that employ direct service workers, is there any movement or is there any idea of any kind of research that you guys would like to do in terms of changing the fact that these organizations are so highly regulatory driven that they're really only concerned about those 20 hours or 40 hours per year of training that staff get in order to meet their regulatory requirements? And then what about the integration of adult theories of learning into this population? Because as we know, a lot of these adults are also in developmental stages, and if that learning is not applicable to them, they're not going to grasp it, and then they're not transferable as well.
Right. Yeah, so one thing that going to your second question first, and then we'll come back to the first one. To your first question about the how the training solidifies, if you will, I would say that it's really different than typical training, right? So your typical training in direct support would be going to a seminar room like this, listening to someone blah, blah, blah for 2 hours about something, getting a certificate at the end and saying, congratulations, have a nice day. This is actually competency-based. So just like a lot of medical schools have gone competency-based, my profession of social work is firmly competency-based, many other professions are competency-based, so too now is direct support. And so in order to kind of move through this process, people have to be accruing competencies and demonstrating those competencies and not just saying, yep, I can check the right box on a quiz, right? The first question.
But I'll do a follow up on that question. To that end, how far along are we toward a certification or licensure for direct support staff? Because in my research, I found that the staff that generally support our population are one of the only categories of direct support staff that aren't required to be certified before hands on work with our individuals.
Yep. So it's not licensure per se, because that would be like a state-regulated thing. But if you go to nadsp.org, the National Alliance for Direct Support Professionals, they have accreditation programs for for training programs, and then they have certification programs, credentialing programs for DSPs, and so that becomes like a portable statements about your commitment to the profession and your general skill base. So if you're interested in learning more about that, it's nadsp.org on the right sidebar. Can I just add something onto that rapidly? I think you're going to see a lot more of this outcome-based stuff coming up because there are several states right now that got sued by the feds, right? So, and I'm shocked that Illinois has not. give it time. But Virginia has been already. Virginia is closing down all of their developmental centers. Rhode Island is in a situation where they're having to downsize all their day programs. So keep your eyes open for a lot more of this kind of natural lab sort of outcome data about downsizing.
I mean, they're closing the state-operated centers. There's still the privately run centers, integrated care facilities as well. So some of them are moving from state-operated to privately operated centers. And some are also moving out into the community. So it depends where they all move to.
Hi, my name is Kristen Clacker. I work at a community-based agency in Illinois, and I actually am the person who was blah, 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 and training coordinators in my agency. So a couple things. Wondering where the curriculum and the modules came from. Did you guys create it? And also, were staff participating in it after an initial baseline of training, of initial training?
Yep. So the staff basically picked up participation in the training wherever they were in their career, right? So some of them would have been new, some of them would have been there for 20 years. The training in our case came from Direct Course, formerly known as College of Direct Support. But again, on this NADSP website, there's a list of maybe six at this point accredited training programs that are assessed to be competency-based and on target for what for validated skill sets that DSPs need to know. So we used Direct Course because we think it's the most comprehensive. But you can check out that list on nadsp.org, again, right sidebar, to see the other accredited programs as well.
Any other questions? Comments? Well, I guess we're done. Thank you again, Mary.